is Iconic with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host JM, and with me as always is Nick.
Hey!
Today we have a Petri-sponsored bonus episode for you. We are going to be taking a look at the Eclipse Phase line from Posthuman Studios. One of the things I love best about this game line is all of the PDFs are available for free from the company. You can go to the link we'll provide in the show notes, and Rob Boyle, one of the leads on the project, posts the downloads on his personal site.
Yeah, that was one of the first things you told me about the Eclipse Phase, and definitely captured my attention. I'm not quite sure how I feel about someone who's either doesn't stand behind their product enough to charge or stands so much behind their product that they're willing to give it away. But after taking a look at it, it's definitely the latter.
It really is. So Eclipse Phase, for those of you who don't know, is a transhuman game of conspiracy and horror. It's set in the near future, but it's really built around the transhumanistic philosophy and mindset and the futurist mentality. The best way to describe transhumanism, for those of you who don't know, everybody should be, if you're in gaming, familiar with cyberpunk. In my mind, cyberpunk is the view of the world that enhancing yourself makes you less human, but you do it to survive. And transhumanism and posthumanism, which I would say is probably an even better term for Eclipse Phase, is about using technology and what is the next step for humanity. What would humanity look like in the future if the technologies we're having now continue to better us? And they do a great job of making it post-apocalyptic and horror, but it still has a lot of the optimism of the transhumanist movement. So one of the parts of transhumanism is about freedom of information, and I really think that's why they provide their books for free, because when you read through all of their books, the way information is shared in their view of the future really supports the...
Yeah, that's something I didn't... that's a thought that didn't quite cross my mind. I did pick up through reading the resources that information is just at your fingertips. I mean, half of a thought away and it's all right there in front of you. And even how that has an impact in your social encounters. You start telling someone about this great movie you saw, and 2 seconds into your spiel, they've already know everything there is to know about the movie. I had not drawn the correlation between the in-game provision of information to the out-of-game. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's very much part of the... I'm a big fan of transhumanism and transhumanistic writings and scientific theories and all of this. So it's what really lured me into Eclipse Phase. So what makes the setting interesting and unique? Why would we do a show about it? Nick, you want to talk a little bit about it?
A couple things that stood out to me as far as that really captured my attention is that, well, one, going back to what you were saying earlier about the transhumanism or posthumanism, the thought that you are not your body. Mm-hmm. You have an identity that is able to be uploaded and backed up and split off and, you know, make a copy of it and put it in another body and being able to swap bodies around, even to artificial bodies or maybe not quite human bodies or what they refer to as uplifted bodies, mm-hmm. where they take some of the more intelligent animals and
give them sentience. Yeah.
Exactly. And so... as far as a player jumping into a situation like that, having the flexibility of, hey, I want to play this. I want to play an octopus because I want to be specialized in this water adventure for the time being. And then a month later, I want to be playing a ginormous synth-created body because I want to, you know, change types and be more of a fighter or heavy lifter or something like that. So from the mechanics, just the thought of being able to swap bodies like that is very appealing. But this is a very hard science fiction world, mm-hmm. or environment.
Well, let me just jump in, yeah. right there. It's not just human minds that can jump from that. You could actually play an uplifted octopus that has been pushed into a human body, or an AI that has been downloaded into a physical body. So the definition of human in this game is very loose and very fluid. But
again, if you think that who you are is really just software code, yeah. it's ones and zeros in a backup somewhere, and I think this kind of plays into the horror that those ones and zeros, they could get changed around. So every time you respawn, you always have to be wondering what has changed. What did I miss? You know, that sort of thing.
Well, and that brings up Nick brings up a good point. One of the things of the setting is it is humanity, transhumanity, and all that encompasses is nigh immortal. In this game, as long as someone is not actively trying to wipe you from existence, the default assumption is that if you die, you're just going to be re-downloaded from a backup because we have gained the technology to digitize and backup human consciousness. It adds, as Nick said, a layer of horror to the game.
Well, there's a tension, I think.
Yes.
Between, hey, I'm immortal. If I die, I'm just going to get a new body versus if someone's really trying to wipe me out, the first thing they're going to go for is the backups, mm-hmm. and then they're going to go for me. And then there's the tension of, well, if I die, am I going to come back?
Right.
And or am I going to come back changed? And will I even know the difference?
And there are things that even transhumanity fears worse than death. And we'll get into that a little bit later. Yeah, it is a very interesting mechanic. One of the ideas I had for when I run this game is I'm going to give everybody a composition notebook and a pen so you can take your notes in red pen to start. And then when you do your next backup, you switch pen colors. And so every time you back up, you switch pen colors. And if you die before you do a backup, I go through your notebook and Sharpie out all of the notes that you took in the previous pen color, because that's one of the things Nick was talking about. If your character is killed before you have a chance to backup or without some of the very expensive and very rare ways to do live backups, basically, you awake with missing memories. In fact, the first story is about a person who wakes up 2 weeks after, well, 2 weeks after his last backup, but it actually turns out to be much longer than that, I believe, because he was on ice for a while. So let's get back into the setting. So it is hard science fiction.
A couple weeks ago, we talked about Numenera and how it was a sci-fi fantasy mashup. And this is that without any of the fantasy.
Yes.
It's definitely science fiction.
It is not going to be your Star Wars or your Star Trek. It's most
no space opera.
No space opera. This is all rooted in current scientific theory, you know, futurist beliefs. The kind of furthest out there they get is the gate crashing, where you use almost Stargate-like portals to different parts of the universe. But even that is rooted in like quantum tunneling and all of that. So it has a very different feel from a lot of science fiction games.
It's also post-apocalyptic.
Mm-hmm.
They don't come out right and say this is exactly what happened, but they said this is the common belief of what happened, that that this company created an AI that was self-aware.
The government created the AIs, yeah, the Titans.
Yeah. And next thing they know, the AIs were wiping out humanity and not just destroying the bodies again, but destroying the backups and even absorbing the backups into their own sentience. And within a matter of months, the majority of humanity was completely wiped out.
Yeah.
So humanity as a whole was on the cusp of
extinction.
Extinction, yeah.
Yeah. The default assumption for the game is that you're playing members of an organization called Firewall. And Firewall exists in this post-apocalyptic setting where Earth is a no man's land because the Titans has retroviruses and all sorts of crazy nanobots that destroy and corrupt and change transhumanity. So humanity's left Earth. They're kind of scattered throughout the solar system. And Firewall exists to investigate and take care of existential threats. And if you're not familiar with that term, it is a threat. It's an extinction level threat. And because the population suffered so greatly in this Titan War, one more good Titan War event and humanity's kind of gone.
Well, and at the end of the Titan War, they just disappeared.
They did just disappear, yes.
So there's the added tension of, are they going to come back? When are they going to come back? How did they leave? The common belief is that they left through a Pandora Gate,
mm-hmm.
which, like James said, are a Stargate-esque portal to different parts of the universe. And there's even conflicting theories about whether or not the Titans created those or just found them and figured out how to use them first. So one of the other things that the Firewall agents do is they gate crash. So they jump through the gate, mm-hmm. sometimes knowing where they're going, sometimes not, figuring out what's on the other side, mm-hmm. doing, again, you know, the Stargate Explorer, and then coming back and reporting if they can.
Right. And there's also, I mean, if you want to focus strictly on gate crashing, I mean, there's corporations that mm-hmm. do it, and it's a very well thought out, very well detailed setting. Setting book wise, they, you know, you have a lot in the core book, and they have books on, you know, a book on gate crashing, just for everything that, you know, how gate crashing works, what's on the other side. They've broken the solar system into the sunward planets and habitats, and the more rimward habitats and planets. Panopticon is a book that just is a setting book. I mean, it's got mechanics in there, but it's basically what would it be like living in a society where you are constantly being watched, because, you know, Even now we're starting to see it with in our current society with social media and all sorts of different Google Glass and all of this stuff. Privacy is shrinking. And in the future, privacy is a commodity that people pay very, very highly for. And for the common person in the Eclipse Phase universe, privacy is a luxury that you can't afford. Everything you do, every moment of the day, is being observed. And so Panopticon really kind of delves into that. Hmm. It's a great book.
That'd be an interesting thing to read, just to get a glimpse for, you know, it. You know, if you don't like that direction that we're headed right now, what it might look like, and maybe coming up with ideas on what you can do to maybe curb that, or go ahead and start pulling back your privacy. And
I don't think they're. I think we are
the cat's out of the bag.
Yeah, I think the cat's out of the bag, and we are on rails for that, at least at this point.
Do they touch at all on virtual societies in that book?
They do.
So basically, there are more backups or more people. Software people than there are physical bodies available. So every time you respond, you're paying out the wazoo to get even a body. But there are a lot of people who, because they can't afford that, or by choice, they just immersing themselves in a entirely virtual environment.
Yes. And that's when Earth fell, the majority of the population escaped by farcasting themselves to databases out in the system. And there, as Nick said, there's a shortage of bodies. So just by being someone lucky enough to be walking around with a corporeal form, you're ahead of the game. And again, it's more terminology things, but you do have, there's a difference between artificial intelligences. So like actual software coded people, not people, but identities, egos, if you will. And then digital backups of people who are basically trapped in a digital limbo. And there are corporations, it does have some very cyberpunk elements, who basically offer you decades of slavery in exchange for being pulled out of these virtual environments so that you can actually get a body, pay it off, and you enter in forms of indentured servitude. I mean, again, it is very much a conspiracy horror game.
And because everyone has to wrestle with the understanding that they could live literally forever, 400 years of being a servant or a slave might be worth it.
Might be worth it. All right. So let's jump from setting to system. So it's crunchy. It's a lot crunchier than I would say 13th Age, but it's far simpler than Shadowrun, which is a game that this game has often been compared to.
See, I've never played, read, or done anything with Shadowrun. So for me, looking at this, this is probably the crunchiest system I've ever encountered.
That's fair. I think because you've played what? You played a couple sessions of Pathfinder, but it was very early levels.
Mm-hmm.
And then really it's been 13th Age and Next and Numenera.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Cyber System.
Yeah, Cyber System.
Well, some of the online stuff, Hero Rises, stuff like that. But again, not very crunchy. You just roll a couple of dice
once you get into the game. Well, so how does Eclipse Phase work? It is a D100 system, so it's percentiles. You are looking to get as close to your target number without going over. Because of the way the game works, you can actually have skills that go over 100%. You have penalties that reduce your skills, bonuses that increase your skills. I actually really like the critical hit and failure system in this, because basically anytime you roll doubles, it's a critical. And if you succeeded in your roll, you've had a critical success. And if you failed, it's now a critical failure. So it's only 10% chance of a critical, but it really depends on your skill, whether you're fumbling or obliterating. Yeah, exactly.
And I honestly, when I read that part of the mechanic, I appreciated that because I don't know who, everyone I know, when they roll a pair of dice and they come up as a pair, there's a little moment of joy like, oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And so to have an in-game effect that's also, oh, that's kind of cool. Or, I mean, if it's a crit failure, then obviously not. But to kind of to bridge that gap between outside the die and the inside the die, I think that was kind of cool. I really like that.
So the GM assigns a target number, or not target number, a target difficulty, and that will either provide bonuses or penalties to your skill. Go from there. I mean,
right, so you said that the goal is to get as close to the target number without going over?
Well, that comes into play when you're in opposition or in combat.
Okay.
Because when you make an opposition roll, there is the chance that both of you succeed. So if I'm trying to punch Nick in the face, Nick's going to roll a defense roll. And if we both succeed, it's the person who rolled higher and succeeded. So if you rolled a 35 and succeeded, but I rolled a 60 and still succeeded, I hit you in the face. But if I rolled a 34 and you rolled a 35, you successfully dodge that. So, but that mechanic applies to everything. I mean, that's kind of your, I'd say 80% of your gameplay is going to revolve around that mechanic. Mm-hmm. Damage works a little differently, but it's still D10s. All you're going to need is a pair of percentile dice to play this. Where the game gets really crunchy is in character creation. There is a lot of number crunching, spending points to buy percentage points and skills and buying morph packages and. In fact, I would say it might have been one of the biggest criticisms, maybe criticism is a harsher term, but you know, one of the biggest negatives of the Eclipse Phase game was the character creation, so much so that when they put out Transhuman, which is kind of the player's guide, they actually give you three other ways to make characters that I think, if you pick up Transhuman, you got a life path system, you've got a package system, and then you actually have a throwback to old Shadowrun, the priority system.
So how long does it take to create a character? Because I know when we did the 13th Age, the entire table had all of their characters done by the end of that first session, and I think we all were kind of itching to jump in. So we had more time than we needed to create all of our characters. If you're going to be running an Eclipse Phase game, how long would it take you to, let's say, have a table of four players, create all of their characters, and get ready to start playing?
Honestly, if you're using the basic rulebook, if that's all you have, download the pre-generated characters for your first game. Because character creation, you might be able to get through it in 4 hours. I would actually set aside two sessions for game and rule, you know, setting and system explanation and character creation.
Wow.
And then be very lenient with your players. And this is just in my personal experience. Be very lenient with your players. Go through and allow them to make changes over the first couple of weeks because they may.
Oh, that's kind of one of your general rules, though.
Yeah. But even like when you switch morphs, some of your mm-hmm. skills are linked to your ego, which is your mental faculties, and they're modified by the morph that they're in. So you may go into a morph that's really good at athletics, so you're going to get a bonus to that skill, but only while you're in that morph. So there's a little bit of math as you're moving through. They do have a character generator. I haven't seen it aside from screenshots, but you can get an Eclipse Phase character generator called Singularity from their website. One of the other neat things system-wise for me is you're in a post-scarcity market. There are cornucopia machines, which are basically nanofabricators, so you're really not in a need for general materials. So in a lot of, unless you're in one of the more regimented areas, political organizations, you're not really going to be using money. Like, money doesn't transfer. And in fact, you know, in this game, you very rarely are using spaceships or to get between planets. You're actually just digitally broadcasting your ego from one point to another, downloading into a new body.
You email yourself.
So the way you generate contacts and favors and resources is actually through reputation. It works. I'm trying to find a real world analogy, but it's almost like Reddit thread where people get positive and negative reviews, and the more positive reviews, the more weight. So think of like an eBay mentality. The more positive interactions you have with a faction, the more you can cash out favors from them.
Well, there's the trope of like a Hollywood movie star walking up to a nightclub and just totally bypassing the entire line.
Right.
And that's an example of being able to use his reputation or his or her reputation as a way of gaining a benefit.
One of the other similarities to Shadowrun that I think Eclipse Phase does better is with the mesh. The mesh is the cyberspace. Hacking in Shadowrun is a nightmare for GMs and players alike. Let's just be honest. I mean, you may love Shadowrun and you may love the hacking, and I might be talking directly to Calvin, but my brain, there's just so many different subsystems. The entire hacking cheat sheet fits on one page. So they've taken a very simple mechanic and elegantly applied it to a variety of different situations.
One of those being maybe even interacting with one of those cornucopia machines. Because yes, while it may have the technical capability of crafting anything, there are software blocks put on it that right. You can't create an atomic bomb using this thing.
WMD or something.
Like right. That. Yeah. So if you come up with the required resources and you hacked it, then you could. But you couldn't just go up to any one of them on the corner and craft whatever it is you want to.
Yeah.
So that's a small example of where you might need to hack something.
Right.
Other things might be you're trying to take over a ship and redirect it.
Finding information in protected servers, that kind of thing. Battling AIs. I mean, there are a lot of really great science fiction tropes that you get to play out in this game. We've talked a little bit about the books that are available. On DriveThruRPG, there are a number of adventures that you can download. And they just put out their latest book was the Morph Recognition Guide, which Cam has at Petri's Family Games, and I've been able to flip through it. It's probably the next gaming book I'm going to pick up. There's nothing new in the book from what I saw, but what it does is it takes all of the morphs throughout all of the Eclipse Phase books, puts them in one book with their stats, and gives a picture for all of them. So you actually can see. It's a great GM reference tool. It's a great player book. And you may be sitting here wondering, hey, Iconic, if you're giving me the website to download these books for free, why would I ever pick them up physically? They're gorgeous. I mean, you'll be able to tell that from the PDF. They're gorgeous. They're high quality. And I don't know about you, Nick, but just looking at the PDFs, I actually wanted to support the company because they were giving me their books for free.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, usually when artists produce their things and provide them for free, like I said earlier, I kind of wonder what's the impetus behind this. And in this case, it was after I got done reading about halfway through the PDF of the core rules and all the way through the quick start rules. After I even got that far, I was about ready to go give them my money just for supporting such a great work.
Yeah, the guys at Posthuman Studios, they're putting out a quality game. It's a little crunchier than 13th Age. It's a lot crunchier than some of the other games we've reviewed. But once you get past character creation, I really think it smooths out quite a bit. And if you like hard science fiction, it is my go-to game for hard science fiction. I think it's the best hard sci-fi game on the market right now. So for 13th Age players, what would you say Eclipse Phase has? What lure does it have, Nick?
I think probably what draws a lot of people to playing 13th Age is crafting a heroic and grand story. And I think that there's still a wide palette for that in Eclipse Phase. It's just in a totally different world. It's the world that we physically live in, push forward a couple hundred years maybe. And so from that perspective, the fact that it's rooted in reality, but it's also fantastical in the sense that it's not reality yet. I think there's a lot of room for imagination and exploring and creating stories. And I think that might draw a lot of 13th Age players. Some people I know are just, they only want to read the high magic, fantasy, the stereotypical fantasy type stuff. And this game probably wouldn't be for them. But I think if anyone has an interest in sci-fi, I think this would definitely be worth looking at. If nothing else, go download the quick start rules and read through. I think it's only like 40 pages or something thereabout. Yeah. And just read it through and see if it captures your attention.
It provides the quick start guide provides a great player's guide as well. Mm-hmm. Like, here's the basic of the setting. Here's the basis of the rules.
And even an adventure in the back of it, so you can kind of get a feel for what it might look like.
Well, and I've had an idea. Because you can craft these meshscapes of virtual reality that are indistinguishable from regular reality. And I know this is a common over-the-edge trope or, you know, just a plot twist that I've seen other GMs use. But get to the end of your 13th age game, when they all die, have them wake up and morph, you know, in bodies and realize that they've been living out this 13th age game.
Interesting.
In a mesh, and just seamlessly move those characters' personalities into an Eclipse Phase game. I've seen it done with people who do D&D, and then the Imperial Army arrives and picks them up and turns them into Space Marines, and they jump from that game into 40K. So,
We try to typically do a White Dragon review rating. So, Jane, what would you rate this book? Or not just this book, because we weren't just looking at one book, but what would you rate the system?
I would rate the Eclipse Phase line for substance in for setting and production quality. I'd give it fives. I mean, there's a lot to grok there. Like, it's a game that I feel, to do justice, it's the exact opposite of 13th Age. Like, Dragon Empire is, here's a couple of nails in a wall that are holding the map up. Drape whatever else you want on there. The Eclipse Phase setting is very fleshed out. It's very well realized. And while you can run it just as a surface level game, the more you dig into it, the more you're going to enjoy out of it. So there's a lot just fun to read there. From a system perspective, it's a little bit crunchier than I like at this point, so I'd probably rate it a 3.5. It's a very solid system, so I would say overall I'd give the game about a 4.
Yeah.
What about you, Nick?
Actually, I mean, what you said kind of sums up my perspective as well. I think for me, the biggest thing that's holding me back from really latching onto it is the crunch of the system. Reading through it, and I understand that when you're actually in gameplay and you roll a die, eventually it's just going to become natural and you're going to know if you're going to, you know, pass or fail or whatever. But as I was reading through it, I kept thinking over and over again, I'm going to need to take a calculator to my game table for this, because you start adding and subtracting all of these different situational modifiers. Either from the environment or from the person you're fighting or something else happened or, you know, all of that kind of stuff, and trying to keep track of all of that and then roll and then figure out, well, they also have to roll and they have to, adjust all their modifiers. I think the crunch of the system really bogged down my love of it. So I probably would end it with a 3.5 White Dragon rating.
Okay.
I love the setting. If the system was easier, I would wholeheartedly buy into it.
Okay. Remind me never to have you play Anima. That game, everyone at my table did have calculators. I stopped rolling at some point. I actually just would come to the table with an Excel spreadsheet filled out with random D100 rolls and check them off as I...
And some people love that.
Yeah.
I like the story a lot more. I like stories a lot more than mechanics. And I feel like the story of Eclipse Phase is masked by the mechanics.
Okay. Well, there you go. That's our we'll put links in the show notes where to get the books, where to buy them. And again, if you download the PDFs and you like them, this is a company worth supporting. I mean, they're out there giving away their products because they believe that much in them. You won't be disappointed if you pick them up physically. They're going to look great on your shelf, and there's lots to pull from there. Well, thanks to Cam and everybody at the Petri's Family Games crew. You can check them out on petrisgames.com.
And if you ever find yourselves in the Colorado Springs area, be sure to look up Petri's Family's Games.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com. or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.